Hey, everybody. Class is in session. Welcome to your weekly smart look at sports. This is The Classroom. We're live from the Marist College Center for Sports Communication in Poughkeepsie. We have been here for a good total of, about 5 minutes, really digging deep in preparing for this program.
I'm dealing with some technical issues.
Keith Struthers dealing with some technical issues, so we'll talk to Mike Wallace. Breakfast. Mike Wallace is dealing with breakfast. He is eating his donuts into the microphone.
Yeah, this one's chocolate.
That sound you hear is...
Do we need the green button? Is that supposed to be off?
No, that's perfectly fine, that green button. This would be the button that can't be on, and it's not on. So,
was it on at any point?
It was not on at any point.
Are you sure?
Yeah, positive.
We actually did a good job.
Yeah, everything's set up fine. Sometimes...
For getting in here 5 minutes prior to the show.
We were feeding our audio back.
No, except we weren't. I understand what the text message says, but it wasn't happening. At least not on our end. Well, unless somebody came in here and moved things again, which does tend to happen in the 6.5 days that we are between shows.
Here's where we are right now. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to lay this out for you. Mm-hmm. I'm about 50-50 whether we're on the air or not.
Yeah, it sounds right. But when are we not? Have we ever done a show? And I'm glad that we're now complaining about our studio again, because this is my favorite thing to do.
Back in our wheelhouse.
Have we ever done a show where we were 100% certain that we were on the air?
Hmm. That's true. There's always that. It's kind of like in Fatal Attraction, where you're just never sure if your partner's going to kill you or not while you're sleeping.
Here's the other great part about our show. We don't need you, meaning the listeners, to do this.
No. If we could have been off for a year, and we'll just continue. But I'm concerned because I just want to make sure that we're good. You know, I'd hate for us to say something that's important and for our listeners not to hear it.
I think there's a very slight chance of that. Everything on our end is exactly how it should be.
All right. All right. Just keep talking. I'm reading. Keep talking. Why are you looking?
Because you're like, all right. Let's now tell the people the end of this saga who are either listening or not listening to us on or not on the air. Are we on? Are people listening to this?
I'm pretty sure we're on.
Hey, all right. Hi, everybody. We finally figured out how this radio thing works.
Yeah, we're on. We're good.
All right, we're good. Just like I said we were. Good job, Mike. Funny story. As Keith Struthers decided to show up here at 9:57 a.m., for a 10 a.m. radio program.
Oh, it's not my fault.
It's 100% your fault. Mike Wallace sitting outside, and we're not at all stressed because, let's face it, you've been later. He's like, this puts a little bit of pressure on me to make sure we get everything set up correctly and quickly. And I go to Mike. I go, Mike, what's the worst thing that happens? We do a bad show? And he goes, that's a good point. What's the worst thing that could happen? This was probably it.
Yeah.
So we've achieved that goal. And to everybody out there listening, the three of you that have kept your radio on the station as Keith Struthers reads his text messages out loud.
Yeah.
Wondering, there is something odd about you wondering into a microphone, ostensibly on air, whether in fact you are on air.
Well, I imagine this is kind of like, let's say you have a traumatic injury and you kind of open your eyes and the first thing that comes to your head is like, is this heaven?
So now that we've confirmed that we are alive and we are broadcasting, here's what we're doing on the program this morning. The NBA, in response to North Carolina's HB2 law, they call it the bathroom law. Really what it does is it eliminates future law. You can't make any new laws that don't allow you to discriminate. It essentially says, what we've got is what we've got. We can have no more. Which just seems like a really stupid law. But
a lot of laws are. That's why they call them laws.
And because there's been such a furor over HB2.
But HB2 essentially also, for the purposes of
it essentially legalizes discrimination.
It legalizes discrimination and has made it such that people are told which bathrooms they can and can't go to in sports arenas and public facilities and so forth. So that hit hard at the LGBT community, or as Donald Trump says, LG. I know I made it 7 minutes before I made it to the Right? He read every letter very deliberately.
Because of HB2, the NBA has decided to remove this upcoming All-Star game from Charlotte,
yes.
Which is a city in North Carolina.
Something they threatened to do, you know, several months ago. Adam Silver said, look, we are unhappy with the law. We think it's discriminatory. That's not the NBA. It's not what we stand for. And they did what most, you know, organizations do, which is throw out a threat. But we'll work with you to find a solution. And I think everyone assumed they would work with them to find a solution. However, the North Carolina state government said, here's the solution. Shove it. I mean, they essentially doubled down.
Yeah.
They doubled down on the law. The federal government has tried to intervene. I mean, obviously, businesses have made it very clear they're not comfortable. And along those lines, and we can get into this as we get into the discussion, it's not as if the organizations, the companies that, you know, that are threatening to leave don't do business in places that also have some pretty serious violations as well. So there is – we can get into the hypocrisy of it. Yes, I by the way, I completely laud the NBA for leaving North Carolina and not leaving, but not having the All-Star game there. On the same note, one of their number one growth areas is China. I don't know what their policies are there towards bathrooms, but I'm sure it's fairly repressive.
Other side of the coin, the NBA owns the WNBA, which this week fined its players for wearing shirts during their pregame warm-ups in support of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yes. Now, in all fairness, they were warned. And I'm not in any way saying that I think this is a good idea, but at least as I heard, they wore them. Then they were told by the league this is a violation.
Correct.
And then they wore them again.
That's exactly right.
Right. And yes. And that's different than what happened in the NBA, where they warned them. I mean, where they wore them, and then the league said, all right, look.
There's a lot of hypocrisy there, and that's what we're going to get into a bit later in this program, especially when you look at the WNBA, which uses its players as activists, as almost paid activists for, as Donald Trump would say, LGBTQ causes.
Yes.
I mean, the WNBA is very closely aligned with the LGBT community in supporting that community. And now they're trying to show support for a different community. Yep. And they're like, hey, whoa, you have to wear this branded warm-up. Otherwise, this whole thing falls apart.
Absolutely. Everyone picks their causes, right? So on the one hand, I suppose I understand to some degree – what the WNBA did. It does seem very off-brand for them. I will say, and I think as we get into this discussion a little bit more, we can make the argument that what the NBA did was also, at least in the long term, probably a good business decision. You could make the argument that the NBA is doing well by being known as an organization that's progressive, that's open and inclusive. And I would argue, while there often can be some backlash, I think in the end it was a good business decision. I think most of America is against North Carolina's decision. I think particularly in their fan base, they probably had a sympathetic ear in the NBA's fan base. And they win this in the long run. It's probably smart. They probably take a short-term hit and a long-term win. I don't even know they take much of a short-term hit. So they move the game. Go to New Orleans. Who cares?
Second hour of this program, we're going to talk about emotional abuse in coaching. Mike Lonergan, the head men's basketball coach at George Washington University, has come under fire this week because I believe 13 former players have accused him of being emotionally and verbally abusive. I think 13 might not be the number that's accused him. That's the number that have transferred out of his program in the last few years. Now, that said, many former players have come out and defended Mike Lonergan and said he's a great coach. He tries to get the best out of you. He's not, all warm and fuzzy all the time. But I had no problems playing for Mike Lonergan. I was very happy that I played for Mike Lonergan. So this is a new thing that we're seeing. You know, 10 years ago, maybe not even that far back, did you ever hear about emotional abuse in coaching? I mean, sure, there was physical abuse, and that's a whole different thing, and that's not okay ever. But it seems like this idea of emotional abuse is something of a new one.
For those of you not able to sit and watch the show, watch the show through the glass here, since we're not on American Ed TV, we're not filming over the summer. Jeff, during the words emotional abuse,
air quoted it.
Did air quotes.
I did air quotes. What is emotional abuse?
This.
What all our listeners are suffering through right now.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine the lawsuit? We cannot listen to The Classroom anymore, citing emotional emotional abuse. So, I mean, look, I'm not a psychologist, although I know many of them, most of them on my payroll. I think there's been a, an acceptance of emotional abuse as kind of a normalization of what happens in coaching, right? You break people down, and then you build them back up, right? That's Bobby Knight.
But not all coaches are like that. Some are.
Right. But I'm just saying that was an accepted practice. And it was almost as if, like, well, if you're going to play for that guy, that's who he is. He's the guy who he really comes after his players. And then they'll say something like, he really loves him down deep, but he is going to make you, you know, cry for your parents, you know, halfway through. Right? And I don't know that that's any different. Obviously, I've never been in the military. And I say obviously because it's very obvious. But because I just don't have the stomach for it. But wouldn't we suggest perhaps, did you order code red? I mean, isn't that what we're talking about here, right? Right. There are those elements of behavioral kind of oversight that probably happen in a lot of organizations. One might suggest in a lot of workplaces in America, it has been emotionally abusive. I do think that changes. You know, you ever talk to people in certain industries, media happens to be one of them, sports certainly is another, where people who have been in the industry for a long time will say, well, we can't do it like that anymore. That's a common thing. We don't get away with that kind of stuff anymore. I think there's a greater recognition that we can't talk to people the way that we used to. And I would say that's probably progress. I'm sure there's a segment of our listening audience that might say that's the wussification of America. But regardless, there are certainly players at GW that suggest that he's crossed the line. I would also say this. GW, wonderful school, very good school. Mm-hmm. But certainly not athletically. I mean, it's a mid-major at best, right?
It's high mid-major.
Is it a high mid?
A-10. Good
I guess,
league.
Yeah, it's A-10. Are they good? Yeah, I guess they're all right. Yeah. Are they? For some reason, I was thinking.
Well, Mike Lonergan's been very successful. He's like 75 and 50 in his tenure.
Were they always? How long have they been A-10?
I can't keep that straight. I have no idea.
They were never in the Virginia Commonwealth situation.
Maybe. I honestly can't keep straight who's in what conference.
I feel like that because I didn't think they were A-10 that long. Regardless.
Now UConn might be in the Big 12.
Yeah, we've heard that.
Figure that out.
No, Houston. You already heard. The lieutenant governor of Texas said, who's more than willing to tussle with the president, he said, look, you take Houston or you deal with me. You come to my house. So it's going to be Houston. You don't want to be messing with the lieutenant governor. Why are you checking your phone now?
Because this is the only place that I have the information on who our second hour guest is, because you showed up to the program 3 minutes before airtime. That's why. So I was going to read off what we're doing in our second hour when we welcome the elite performance manager of Woomp.
Woomp Elite.
I'm sorry. There's no M. Woop.
Woop Elite.
Woop Elite. We'll be in the classroom in the second hour, and once we figure out what that is.
No, we know what that is.
I know, we know what it is. It's actually a really, really, really cool thing you want to stay tuned for.
It's using analytics to make people better athletes.
They're using, but not only like external analytics, like, you know, the way you'd use, you know, oh, hey, your stride length is too long or what have you, but internal body
sensors,
characteristics.
Yes, exactly.
So you can train and recover better.
They'll tell you, you know, you should be sleeping more, you should be walking less, you should be doing X, Y, and Z, eating this, drinking more. And they're using it particularly with Olympic athletes, performance-based sports. And our guest is a former Olympian and gold medalist.
Good time of year to talk about the Olympics.
I met a couple athletes out in San Francisco last week.
Yeah, you cursed Dan Dickow.
I didn't curse Dan Dickow.
You said, good luck, Dan, in the basketball tournament, and then his team got whooped yesterday.
Oh, did they lose?
Yeah, they sure did.
That was my fault. Because I said, I'll see you in New York. I think I jinxed him.
They gone.
Really, what team did he play for?
What team did Dan Dickow play for? He played for the Gonzaga team. A few good men.
Oh, they had a Gonzaga. Oh. They lost?
Yep.
This tournament, by the way. So let's get into this. I watched a little bit of the basketball tournament. This thing, and we'll have the founder of the tournament on at some point before the finals. When are the finals?
2 weeks.
I may not make it to that.
Wait. Next week.
Next week?
Yeah, I forgot we're so late in July anyway. I think it's July 30th and August 2nd, something like that.
All right, I think I'm going to go down.
Okay.
You want to go?
Yeah, I'll go with you.
All right, let's go. All right, that's going to be great. It's down, where is it?
Rose Hill Gym in Fordham.
All right, we'll be there.
I love how you're like, I'm going to go. When is it? Where is it?
Well, what day is it? What day of the week?
I think it's either a Friday and a Sunday or a Saturday, I think. Saturday and Sunday. I don't know, the weekend?
I'm going to the finals.
Okay.
I got to be down in the city anyway. That's great. All right, so we'll go. I'll go watch that. I did him in, huh?
You cursed him. Oh. You saw Dan Dickow
on the
street.
I was watching a little bit last night.
So was I.
This thing is loaded.
It's good.
It's loaded.
Yeah.
There's some really, like, there's a lot of, like, this is no joke. You've got good kind of, you know, teams that are playing, local teams that have gotten themselves together. And then you've got serious former professional and you know, high-level major guys who are playing. Like,
Mike Bibby and White
Chocolate.
Yeah. Who were playing
yesterday.
Did they
lose last night?
They did.
Oh, man. I mean,
in fact, here's what's weird about what's happened in the tournament in the round of 16. All of the, like, compelling teams have lost. The Syracuse team is out. The Gonzaga team is out. The team with Mike Bibby and Jason Williams is out.
It ends
and
up
so
being
now,
the teams.
Now all you're left with are good teams,
yes.
But you're left with, like, the team of Bradley College alumni, which are great, great basketball players, just not that compelling.
Now, I think, honestly, in the end, what it seems to affirm, at least I'm watching the finals last year, good teams trump a bunch of former good athletes who try to lace it up.
Of course. I mean, in something like this, you could definitely tell the teams that have a system and are running something and have played together before versus the teams that just sort of are trying to ball out.
Yeah, I mean, I'll play. What time? Like, yeah, these guys obviously play a lot of regional tournaments and are really good. Could you imagine, like, playing them in, like, a YMCA? Like,
well, I'm not good at basketball, so no, I couldn't. Nor do I think they could.
I will also say
me.
This. Here's why I understand what you're saying. It's more compelling to have White Chocolate playing in the finals, and that's kind of cool. Former NBA guy and all that, and Dan Dickow, former NBA guy, that would be fun. The Dan Dickow, by not tall, like, he is not a guy.
That's the Gonzaga way.
But you look at him, and I was like, wow, that's Dan Dickow. Like, handsome too.
We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the NBA taking the All-Star Game out of Charlotte in response to the HB2 law, colloquially known as the bathroom law. That's ahead. More of your weekly Smart Look at Sports next here on Fox 12 20 97.3 ESPN Radio. Go ahead and like The Classroom on Facebook. Search for ESPN The Classroom. Follow us on Twitter at ESPN_Classroom. And catch the archives of all of our past shows, at least the ones in recent memory, on iTunes. Mm-hmm. Search for ESPN The Classroom in the podcast section.
Yep. Oh, we had, by the way, just a little inside baseball. We had some pretty good download numbers last week.
That's good. What's pretty good for it? Actually, let's not. Don't even.
What do you
write
think?
It down on a piece when of paper. Write it down on a piece of paper. Slide it across the table.
Like
I'll look at
like
it. It's
a job offer. What do you think good is?
I don't think we should get into this publicly.
Just so we don't embarrass ourselves?
Yeah, because I think we're going to be like, oh, what, like 15?
No. Triple digits.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
I like
but
that.
Look, I'm going to lay out a little challenge to our listeners here. All right? And maybe part of it's on us. We need to do a better show, and we need to publicize it
more.
That's
probably not going to happen. We're going to need to pick up the slack here, people.
But here's what I'd like. I'd like to see in the near future, I'd like to see a four-digit number for a download.
Ooh.
What do you think? That's big. That's big time.
I'd like to see it. Unless, but maybe I wouldn't like to see it. Because let's be honest. If we get a download number with a comma in it, it's probably because one of us said something so inflammatory that it got picked up by the outside
world.
Yes,
because Deadspin's told everyone to go find it. Yep, that's true. That's true. But here's what I'd also say. You never know when we're going to have one of those shows. So go ahead and download it. Look for it. Find the secret curse word. It's like Pokemon Go.
It's nothing like Pokemon Go. Stop trying to be culturally relevant.
No, it is. Aren't you trying to find the secret Pokemons?
They're not secret. Wait, Mike, are there secret Pokemon? I don't play
yes,
the Pokemon Go.
Everyone's just like
I don't play either.
Everyone's
just
like hunting around Central Park, like
it's
looking
not
for
Pokemon,
the secret.
I don't think they're secret. Yeah. I think they're there. That's the point.
They're secret
there,
to
there
me.
There are rare Pokemon.
There are rare Pokemon. Yeah.
They are.
You're not finding a Snorlax on every corner.
Nope.
They are secret.
No.
I don't think they're secret. I think they're rare.
That's secret. Yeah.
So everyone can see them. Where are they now?
They're all around us.
But how do I find them?
You have to download the app on your phone.
But what I mean, are they literally like just holograms? Am I going to see them?
Okay.
In real life or on your phone?
It's a video game.
Right.
So no.
So how do I see them? What am I looking for?
Oh, they're on your phone. There's a map on your phone that shows you where the Pokemon near you are, and you have
Pokemon?
To walk to them. And you have to walk to them.
It'll take control of your camera so you can see it on your phone.
Oh, so it's only
Marist
on phone.
College, by the way, apparently a hotbed of Pokemon.
Yeah. So you, like, if you download it on your camera, maybe there's one like sitting on Jeff's head or something.
It's possible. Yeah. It has happened. I have had Pokemon on me.
Can you get like a spray, like a repellent, a Pokemon? Why am I saying Pokemon?
Because that's the right way to pronounce
Pokemon.
It.
I don't think so. No,
it's
Pokemon.
It's not. There's an accent mark on the E.
Pokemon.
L-G.
Oh, I would give an awful, by the way. If I were a candidate, I would give an awful speech.
Awful. I imagine you would make the dystopian hellscape that Donald Trump outlined look like a weekend at Disney World.
Well, I would just misread everything. I would butcher every name. Could someone do phonetics? Not on everything. Everything. Even common words. Everything. If it's got more than one syllable or even a single silent letter, I need it phonetically. Nothing to chance here. Never read off teleprompters that are the glass teleprompters. I've never done that.
No, I've never done that either. I imagine it's exactly the same as reading off a regular teleprompter.
Except for you're looking at it, someone's behind it. I'm like, oh, I'm reading off that guy's chin. Because you're looking at glass. You can see right through it. That's what glass does.
You do realize that all teleprompters are glass.
Yeah, but they don't – they're not see-through.
You got some non-see-through glass where you're from?
Most tele – okay.
Are glass and mirrors. All of them.
Yes, but it's black behind it. You can't see through them.
Okay. Here's how a teleprompter works.
I know how a teleprompter works.
The screen on the bottom in reverse has the text, and then that's broadcast up via a mirror.
Right.
And then the mirror reflects it back to you. That's why it's in reverse. The background of the text, you're ready for me to blow your mind, is black.
Right.
So when you look at the glass teleprompter, what it's reflecting back to you is a black background.
You are annoying
so
me
you're
now.
Not looking at text on some guy's chin, but believe it or not, we have this crazy technology where it's dark.
Oh, so they're not just words?
They're not just words in space.
I imagine more like Star Wars.
This seems like a good time to remind the folks that Keith Strother has many advanced degrees, one of them from an Ivy League institution.
Well, I don't have a – never took a teleprompter technology class. I'll tell you that much. I should have, though.
I tell you, common sense, just not all that common. Let's get to this morning's big story.
You are right, though.
What?
How is he right?
I know what he's talking about.
Words in space.
Yeah.
That's not what
it – No, don't describe it like that, because that would be wrong.
A see-through teleprompter.
Yes.
But that's not what it is.
Oh, I'm going to find one.
That's what it looks
like. Get to the big story.
The big story.
Keith Strutter's literally Googling see-through teleprompter.
It does exist.
The NBA this week has decided to pull next year's All-Star game out of Charlotte. And the reason that they have done it is because of the state's so-called bathroom law, HB2, the controversial law. Prevents cities from creating non-discrimination policies based on gender identity. It also mandates that students in state schools use the bathroom that corresponds with the gender on their birth certificate. The NBA joining a long line of people that have removed events from North Carolina as a result of this legislation. That list includes Bruce Springsteen, Maroon 5, Pearl Jam, and perhaps most devastatingly, Nick Jonas and Demi Lovato.
Oh, no, I like Nick Jonas.
I do, too.
I could get that song Jealous queued up at some point. You know I like it. It's one of my favorite Nick Jonas songs.
The NBA, as we mentioned at the top of this program, initially declined to move the All-Star game, saying, look, they're going to give North Carolina some time to get their house in order, maybe reconsider this legislation, and hopefully they would not have to move the All-Star game. It seems as though North Carolina will not be doing anything of the sort. So the NBA this week said that they've reached sort of the line of as far as they can go without deciding on where the All-Star game needs to be next year, and said, if you're not going to do anything, North Carolina, we're shipping out to New Orleans. It has been estimated by CNN Money that the decision to remove the All-Star game from Charlotte will result in an estimated loss of $100 million to Charlotte's economy. And you also have to consider North Carolina's place with greatest NBA player of all time, Michael Jordan.
As the owner of the franchise
he
there.
He owns the Charlotte Bobcats. He was – or the Charlotte Hornets now. What they were, then they weren't. Now they are again.
Are they the Hornets again?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Why are you looking at me?
Well, because you're the intern. That's what interns do. Interns, right. When did that happen?
Couple years ago.
Well, I was looking up the prompter, which I did find. By the
look,
way.
Yeah, look at the background. It's black.
No, it's see-through.
You're see-through.
Look at the background of the words.
No,
the thing is see-through, so people aren't looking at a giant screen in front of the person's face. But the text is on a black background.
No, I'm seeing through it. I'm seeing right through it.
Yeah, you can look at the audience.
I can see through that.
The text is on a black. You said there are words on some guy's chin, and there aren't.
Yes, there are. Ugh. No, not. It's not floating. It's not a hologram or whatever that is, but it's floating. All right, just come on.
My head hurts.
Pull it together. All right, but yeah.
Me pull it together.
I asked you
2014,
one...
by the way.
What's that?
2014, they became
2014?
The Hornets.
2014? All right, so.
Anyway, Michael Jordan was hoping the All-Star game would be a showcase for the Hornets.
This is rough on all, you know, for a long list of reasons, but none the least of which being that they still have an NBA team there.
They do.
So the you know, it's one thing when you say, look, we will never play here or we'll never play there. The NBA is there.
Yes.
Like, the NBA has to – they're going to have 40, you know, home games there.
NFL's
a year.
There as well?
The NFL – well, that's not their problem. But the NBA has the problem that they have just kind of – And I understand there will be people that will champion what they did in North Carolina, but they're going to agitate a bunch of fans in that state who are going to say things like, look, I want my sports to be, without politics. They should just come here and play the game. They're taking it out on the fans. That kind of rhetoric. And that could make it very hard for the NBA team of undetermined name that plays in the state of North Carolina to do business. That's tough.
Let's welcome Peter Kaufman into the classroom, a professor of sociology at nearby SUNY New Paltz. Mm-hmm. Studies sport and activism. We've got a real Hudson Valley local, yes. Think local first flavor to the program this morning. Peter Kaufman, good morning. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
We are talking about the NBA moving the All-Star game out of Charlotte because of the HB2 bathroom law. Is this a good decision made by the NBA?
Well, it's a good decision from my perspective, but I'm not an NBA stakeholder in that regard. But yeah, I mean, I think this is a great decision by the NBA, and it's a matter of the NBA sort of throwing their weight around and demonstrating that these issues of social justice and inequality are not going to be part of the NBA culture as much as they can do something about that. So. Yeah, I mean, I think this is great. You know, the NBA gave Charlotte or the state of North Carolina some time to think about it. North Carolina didn't take action, basically snubbed them. And the NBA, you know, they said, okay, fine, we're going to pull the game. And, I think that sends a really strong message to the fans, to the country, and even to the players who are, are developing or at least expressing more interest in taking, positions on issues of social inequality.
Do leagues or franchises have an obligation to react to legislation like this?
Well, I think they do. I mean, I know, it's not, as I heard you guys just saying a second ago, a lot of people think, athletes should just play and not, sports shouldn't be politicized. But, we all live in this country and we're all invested in the country. We all pay taxes. So I think it's totally fine for leagues and players to state their political positions. I mean, particularly when it comes to issues like this, laws that are just so blatantly discriminatory, if you have the power to stand up to that and the power to actually try to affect change, then yeah, I think that's an obligation as a citizen of this democracy. I mean, that's what this country was founded on.
What would you say to an argument that, yeah, they pulled out of a game in North Carolina, which, in the end of the day, I actually, and maybe I'm overthinking this, think it's actually a pretty good business decision for them. It makes them look pretty good. It's not going to cost them anything. They're going to go play the game in another city, and that'll
sure.
be fine. You know, this isn't even moving the Super Bowl, which is something that was threatened a long time ago. So it's just not that big of a deal. It's a showcase. They can play it anywhere. They can move it on a dime, right? But they're still doing business in countries that do a lot worse. You know, they have a big operation in China that's a growth place for them. We've got players that are going off to the Olympics from the NBA, and that's, God knows what's going on there. What about the argument that, like, yeah, that's great. When it looks good for them and it's easy and it's convenient, they'll be political. And when there's a lot of business at stake, they'll go to China and have a showcase. What do we say to that?
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly, you can't deny that there's some truth to that. But, who of us are totally consistent in all of our views and all of our actions? And this is not to let the NBA off the hook. I mean, I certainly think that that, yeah, they should examine some of that other stuff. But, you know, I mean, we're talking about social change, we're talking about injustice on a global level, you know, that would be like, well, you know, none of us individually, if we're so committed to the cause, can wear shirts from other countries because we know they're made in sweatshops. I mean, so there has to always be a limit, whether you're an individual or an institution, regarding the extent to which you can put your politics into practice. And, you know, this is one step that they knew they could take that wasn't going to, you know, have tremendous ripple effects, as you're saying. I think in the end it's not, you know, it's not a big deal for the NBA in terms of a loss of money, though I think it's a big deal in terms of the symbolic statement that they make, and it brings more attention to this, you know, reprehensible law. But yeah, I mean, you know, but they're still doing business in places that we wouldn't appreciate. You know, I was doing research on activist athletes, and, you know, that was one of the things I was sort of talking about was the issue I brought before, like sweatshop labor. You know, and so you have athletes that are speaking out for certain issues, but, you know, would they speak out for, you know, the workers that are making the clothes or making the sports equipment that they rely on? You know, and they may not have that level of consciousness, or they may not be able to take it, you know, that far. It's almost like the 6 degrees of separation thing. It's like, okay, well, I understand people in my community who might be suffering, but thinking about somebody in, you know, in Southeast China, that might be a different, you know, that's just beyond what I'm able to think about or at least take action on. So, you know, I think we have to recognize the limits of people when they start becoming agents of change, you know, and not necessarily tear them down for not being 100% consistent in all of their actions and beliefs.
Well, and speaking to that consistency, I mean, they still have a team there, and they're going to play a full schedule there, and that team is going to have to abide by this law in that arena for the course of an entire season. And it's not like the NBA is going to say, you can't play there, we're going to move these games to South Carolina. Oddly enough, South Carolina. Well, would we have ever thought of South Carolina as the more progressive of the
Carolinas? It's a fair point. But now we are starting to see refusal of sports teams to play in the Carolinas. It happened in New York State here. Governor Cuomo has banned all non-essential state travel to North Carolina, and that means that the University of Albany men's basketball team will not be opening their season at Duke. They have been banned from playing at Duke.
That's so good. That's so actually good news for University of Albany.
So it's I mean, in at least, you know, state-affiliated athletics,
sure,
it is happening.
And I think at universities, it's probably even more challenging because they do in many ways, because of their charter and their mission statement, do have to abide by a slightly more ethical creed. I mean, the NBA,
they're funded by public dollars. Well, there's more accountability.
But they do have a mission statement that does, you know, does include ethics and righteousness and that. The NBA is just a business, and they can follow the dollars.
We're talking with Peter Kaufman, professor of sociology at SUNY New Paltz, studies sport and activism. We mentioned at the top that the NBA All-Star Game is not the only major event to pull out of Charlotte. Some businesses are dropping plans to either expand upon or enter the Charlotte metropolitan area. PayPal, Deutsche Bank.
We were going to syndicate there, but, you know, now we're just
going to
wait. We're going to wait. Well, I'm going to ask you a serious question.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a very serious question.
Oh, that's how we know this isn't. But you're smiling as you say it. Go ahead.
You get a call from...
Yes.
Okay. Okay. We'd be on the air in Charlotte and Raleigh tomorrow. Is that what you're
tomorrow
saying?
Tomorrow. Tobacco Road, great country, great part of the country. I disagree with some of their political... some of their political views.
We want you to do... All right, let me take it. We want you to do a road show at the Dean Dome.
Sure. Listen, I'll go there. Listen, you got to change habits from the inside. You got to get into the belly of the beast. The belly of the beast. Peter, is this going to matter? Is PayPal and Deutsche Bank not doing business in Charlotte? Is the NBA taking the All-Star Game away from North Carolina? Is Bruce Springsteen not playing concerts in North Carolina? Is any of this going to matter, or is it only going to strengthen the resolve of the proponents of HB2?
I think these things do matter. I mean, I think, you know, eventually they add up, you know, figuratively and literally, and, you know, it gets to be a bit of a breaking point for the state of North Carolina. You know, certainly in Indiana, they fell under some of the pressure and they, you know, finessed their law a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, I think, if you want to call this corporate activism, I think corporate activism certainly can make a difference because, as you all know, I mean, you know, these states and the country runs on the bottom line, you know, and a lot of it comes down to economics and money. And so certainly if enough businesses put pressure on North Carolina and said they're going to pull out like that, then I think you would see a quicker turnaround or a quicker action other than what, you know, the governor sort of just sort of figuratively flipping the bird to the NBA and saying, well, fine, we're not, you know, screw you, we don't need you. But I think if enough businesses did that, then they would be singing a different tune.
Yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, look, I'm surprised that things didn't change, particularly in light of what happened in Orlando, that there might have been some softening on this issue. In South Carolina, let's be honest, that Confederate flag came down from the State House because of a mass homicide, and that drove that rhetoric. It wouldn't have happened otherwise, even though a lot of sports organizations had said, we're not playing there.
I think NASCAR deserves some credit for that. I mean, NASCAR came out and banned the Confederate flag at their races, and
NASCAR,
I think that was sort of a big tipping point.
And NASCAR, ironically,
is
located
in Charlotte.
So it all seems to – the Confederacy seems to be right there. But let's shift over to one of the affiliate organizations of the NBA, the WNBA, which seems to have taken
How about before we do that, we got to take a quick break. Peter, can you hang out?
That's what you were trying to tell me.
Can you hang out with us for a couple minutes? When we come back, we'll talk about the other side of the coin with the WNBA fining its players for wearing shirts in support of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, that's fine.
We'll take a break. We'll come back more with Peter Kaufman from SUNY New Paltz after this. Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. Back in the classroom, I'm Jeff Peacekeith. Peter Kaufman is on the line, a professor of sociology at SUNY New Paltz right here in the beautiful Hudson Valley. It's really hot out there today.
Yeah, it's brutal. You weren't talking to me, though.
Heat index in the hundreds.
Well, it's 100.
Yesterday on the golf course, the felt like was 105.
Is that now you got that
That's
from
hot.
Where? Where'd you get that from?
From my weather app on my cell phone. I don't have a weather station in my living room. I got my weather the same way everybody else gets it. I like how you're like, so now, I mean, can you really trust that?
No, I didn't.
Do you even have a barometer in your kitchen?
Some people do the, like, it feels like it's 120 on the turf. And I'm like, well, based on what? Because they put a thermometer out there. I guess that's a pretty good, actually, barometer. I guess, I suppose that actually would be a great way to figure it out. But I didn't know. Would you ever be one of those weather reporters that, like, they're like, hey, you know, Jeff and Poughkeepsie said it was 94 this morning. Like, you know, they feature them on the news.
Yeah, I would never be that person. No, that's not me. No. I don't think the world needs to hear my perspective on temperature. I think we have other means of determining what it is.
What do those people get out of that? Like, what's their deal?
I think that there are a lot of people who think incorrectly that others care what they think.
But, like, what's your deal being like, yep, I want to be one of the weather team folks? Like, what
I don't know. I can't put myself in that headspace. I don't know.
I've never been there. I've never been asked. It's never been
good.
I volunteer, I suppose. But then there's responsibility. Then I actually have to get up and be like, all right.
And you avoid responsibility. You hate it.
Yep. That's true. I like to know that there's always someone else I like to oversee responsibility.
Direct quote from Keith Strudler early this morning before we went on air. I just want to do what I want to do.
Oh, well, now you got me on this. But yes.
Well, like, let's take you off of it quickly, because I do want to finish our discussion with
then
Peter.
Don't get me wound
Peter
up
Kaufman from
and
New
then
Paltz.
Think I'm going to calm down.
I consistently, and I'd like to apologize to our listeners for this, consistently fall into the trap of thinking that Keith Strudler is a reasonable adult who can focus for more than 35 seconds at a time.
Once I get going down a pathway of thought, it's on.
You are a cat with a laser pointer.
And you just keep moving that beam, and I'm chasing it.
So the NBA has pulled out of Charlotte. It's removed the All-Star game from North Carolina in response to the HB2 law, showing that the league has no problem making political statements.
Right.
So the WNBA has, which is owned by the NBA, fully supported by the NBA.
Amortized, some might say.
Has fined this week the Indiana Fever, the New York Liberty, and the Phoenix Mercury, fined the teams and the players on the teams for wearing warm-up shirts in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. All the teams were fined $5,000. Each player that wore the shirts were fined $500. They levied the fines under the league's uniform policy. While the shirts were branded Adidas, which is the league's official outfitter, the rules state that the given uniforms cannot be altered in any way. And that's why these players were fined. Keith Strudler, a bit of hypocrisy here.
A bit of hypocrisy. And interestingly, Seattle Storm came out with a photo today.
They did it after the other teams got fined. They're like, well, if you're going to fine them, you're going to fine us too.
Exactly. And so there was a sign of solidarity there. It is interesting. The fine numbers are a little different in the WNBA than the NBA. I mean,
the economics a little different.
Economics a little bit different. I mean, we always wonder, like, you know, you find an NBA player. If you find an NBA player $500, he would just reach into his pocket and hand you, you know, five $100 bills.
He'd be like, I don't have anything smaller than $1,000. Can you make change?
Or just, you know what? This is for the next one. Just hold on to it. So there is clearly, one might suggest, a bit of hypocrisy. There are some differences. I don't suggest that any of these organizations have ever said, we don't care about our rules, right? And if nothing else, even the NBA, which is a little bit looser than, let's say, the NFL, which is very strict on you have to do this, and dealt a lot with when players were dealing with, making statements, whether putting their hands up and some of the other things that happened a couple of years back in the NFL. The NBA and all professional sports leagues do care about their rules. They said, hey, this is you're non-compliant, and when they did it again, they fined them. The NBA has a legacy of doing that. When players were out of uniform or out of code or weren't in dress code, they made a big stink about it and made sure that they either were in code and wearing ties and this and that and the other, or they were going to fine them severely. So I agree. I think, there has to have been a way for them to have let them know they couldn't do this and be out of code and allow them away without fining them. There had to have been a way to kind of privilege their political statements without doing, because it's not, I don't think anyone disagrees that athletes probably, there's a dress code, blah, blah, blah. But, and I think most athletes would probably agree that, hey, that's an okay thing to do. On the other hand, the fines made the WNBA look bad. I think more than it just made them look bad. And so I don't have a great answer to this. Hopefully Peter has a better answer than I do.
Yeah, Peter, your perspective on the WNBA fining its teams and its players for supporting the Black Lives Matter movement in the same week as the NBA has moved the All-Star game.
In all fairness, after being warned. They did it for the first time, and there was no fine. And then after said being warned, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is definitely a bit of hypocrisy, given that it happened, sort of juxtaposed with the Charlotte decision. But, I think I agree with you, Keith, that, would have been, I think there could have been maybe a more diplomatic way to basically condone what the players did, because I think the NBA probably does support them and not levy the fine. I mean, I know the fines, they seem like they're a little amount, but of course the WNBA players make much less than the NBA players. I think that the average salary is less than $100,000. $5,000 for the team, that just seems like, a little bit of a symbolic slap on the wrist. I don't know why they necessarily had to do that. I don't think they, like we were talking about how there's not really anything that they're going to lose from pulling out of Charlotte. I don't really see that there's anything they're going to gain from finding these players. The other thing about the players is that they weren't just wearing Black Lives Matter. They were also wearing shirts honoring the Dallas police.
True.
And I think that's important to acknowledge too, and the things that these players said, were very, thoughtful and genuine things. And, I don't think the NBA really gained much by doing that.
Peter, when it comes to the activism that sports leagues and sports franchises are, comfortable with, is it true that not all causes are created equal? That there are certain causes that leagues are much more inclined to allow its players to support and to maybe even do so outside the bounds of the rules than there are others?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely the case. I mean, I was thinking of even just this example. I mean, they're wearing shirts about Black Lives Matter, the Dallas police, but what if they were wearing, what if they're doing political activism for some issue that, wasn't as widely accepted, I'm always, thinking hypothetically and like as a professor, as an educator in the classroom and think, well, I can't imagine this happening today, but, what if they were wearing shirts saying, like some team, that wanted to promote some, far right type of agenda, like the Confederate flag, it seems sort of preposterous and silly, but, but we're talking about athletes taking a stand for something that they believe in. It just so happens to be something that, at least myself and I think you guys, can get behind. But what if it was a political issue that, you know, people or some people didn't, or certainly some people.
Curt Schilling basically
it.
Lost his job because of that. We've talked about this a lot. You know, would we be as comfortable if these protest movements come from the right? And typically when they come on the other side, and it's a little bit of hypocrisy here, they often are denounced and sometimes fired.
I mean, you bring up the Confederate flag. I'm in my head now. I'm wondering what happens if the Atlanta Braves show up to batting practice with a Confederate flag t-shirt on that says Heritage, Not Hate. What would happen in that instance?
Oh,
I would imagine there would be an insane backlash.
It would go straight. It would be up to the president, I would imagine. And we'd probably all say, of course, that's right. So how do you deal with that hypocrisy? And I don't want to – hypocrisy is a loaded term because perhaps there is right and wrong.
Inequitable standard.
Discrepancy. Yeah. How do we deal with the discrepancy that we – and I say we because perhaps we have certain political ideologies.
Oh, we're dirty liberals here. I wonder if that's been apparent.
I don't know how you deal. I mean, I think, you know, I guess I would not to try and skirt your question, but I think that these acts of activism, I think the importance of these is that they're basically bringing these issues to the forefront and they're getting people to dialogue about these issues, to think about these issues, and to challenge each other. You know, like for some people, it's might be confusing when the WNBA players have a shirt that says Black Lives Matter and the Dallas Five. You know, and then they have to figure out, well, what does that mean? Where do I stand on this? You know, how do I make sense of that? You know, we have to talk about all the young people who wake up and, you know, have tremendous respect and admiration for these players or these leagues, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, my league is taking a stance on the bathroom law, and my favorite player is speaking out against, you know, Black Lives Matter or, you know, or Don't Shoot. And all of a sudden, you know, these ideas that maybe were in certain circles now reach out to a much larger audience. You know, people get validated, people think about these issues, and I think the national conversation gets pushed along. Not that that sports is going to be the only vehicle to do this, but it's certainly, you know, I think is an important vehicle because it's a, you know, such a powerful institution in our society. We have to have that conversation so we can sort of untangle a lot of those hypocrisies.
One final question before we let you go. I'll play hypocrite. Or I'll play cynic here, perhaps.
Okay.
Are the athletes that are involved in some of these, you know, these movements and the leagues, are they really actually putting them out there or putting themselves out there? Or are we giving a lot of kind of credit where perhaps they're not taking a whole lot of risk? You know, they're taking a lot of safe, making a lot of safe gestures and not really putting.
I think they're safe to us because we agree with them.
Well, but let me put it this way. There isn't a Muhammad Ali there. We haven't seen the kinds of risk-taking necessarily. Like I said, the NBA, sure, they won't play their game there, but they aren't going to pull their team out of there. Players, yes, they'll speak out vocally at the ESPYs, but they're not going to stop working with the sponsors they work with. And they're right. Are they actually heroes? Or are they simply just speaking out what they believe?
Well, I would, you know, from my perspective, I do give some of these players credit for taking the action that they are, because I think for many of the previous, most recent generation, and of course I'm referring to Michael Jordan, there was a lot of silence, you know, maybe even, you know, a sense of apathy. And I think for this generation of players, from the WNBA to the NBA to even college players, and it's not just Black Lives Matter, it's you know, gay and lesbian, transgender athletes that are taking positions, I think that's really significant. I mean, I think I wouldn't say it's a total sea change, but I certainly think that, you know, that for athletes to feel comfortable to do this is an important step. Now, yes, you know, none of them are necessarily Muhammad Ali, but they're, you know, they're taking steps within their sort of level of comfort and from what they're, you know, being able to do or have thought about what they can do, and that's a great step in the right direction, you know, because a lot of athletes before them, and certainly a lot of athletes still, either don't want to have any part of it or don't even know really what the issue is. And I don't mean even not just athletes. I mean, you know, people in the country don't know what some of these issues are. And so how could they even take action? And so for the athletes to do that, I think they should be applauded. I mean, you know, I don't know if I would throw around the term, you know, heroes and stuff like that, but they're they're being activists. You know, they're acting. They're taking an active role in the world and the reality that they live in, and I think that's really laudable.
Peter Kaufman, a professor of sociology at SUNY New Paltz, right across the river, is our guest in the classroom this morning. Thanks so much for coming on. Next time, we'll bring you across the bridge. We'll have you in studio.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd love to. Thanks, guys.
Ah, good guest. A local guest.
Well, we don't do that often.
That was good.
Because most people locally, they've heard us.
They're like, oh, I'm not venturing into that maelstrom.
I mean, so they know. We get people from out of the region, really, a lot, because they're unfamiliar with what they're about to do.
I will just say,
we didn't ask Peter. This is how we lose our guests. We didn't ask him one of our ridiculous questions, like if you had to eat someone.
Oh, if you could eat one person in the world, who would you eat?
Yeah, that's usually
how much money is enough money for you to never work again.
I wonder what Peter's number is.
I still think the best question that we've ever asked, and the one that reveals the most about someone, is what is the largest amount of money that, or what is the smallest amount of money that you consider a large amount of money?
Did it hurt you to lose?
That's a great, yeah. Like if you lost it, you'd be like, oh. That stings.
Yeah.
That reveals a lot about a person.
Well, it does. I actually think the who would you eat says a whole lot about you.
It does, but that's ridiculous. Because I think everybody at some point in their life has lost money. Whether it's, you know,
gambling,
I had a dollar, I lost, whatever. I think it's a feeling everybody can relate to. I would imagine most of us cannot relate to eating a person.
Where was I during this debate?
You were in Florence, I'm assuming.
And I can download the podcast?
Well, yeah, okay. I can make sure you get it.
Yeah, we can find the archive.
I kind of need to.
So, and I don't even actually know how this came up.
I don't remember either.
But I do remember that it was a question that was asked to Patrick McEnroe.
Yeah, it was. That's what we do on this program, which is The Classroom, your weekly smart look at sports. We've got a whole another hour of it coming up.
Do you think that we can go to this break and return from the break without messing up the audio board?
Oh, boy.
No.
Because there's three people in this room right now.
And
there's fault's gonna have to fall somewhere. And I'm absolving myself because I'm the furthest away from it.
Well, it's obviously your fault.
It's not my fault.
You were the one who was late, so we couldn't get in the studio early to do our normal pre-show testing.
How would that have helped?
Anything? Also, you have anointed yourself executive producer.
I am the executive producer.
And as the chief executive, the buck stops with you.
Heads are gonna roll.
When we come back, we're going to talk about Mike Lonergan, the head men's basketball coach at George Washington University, who's under fire and under investigation for being emotionally and verbally abusive to his players. Over the last number of years, 13 players have transferred out of the Colonials program. Now, players are also speaking up in support of Mike Lonergan. How much is too much when it comes to the way coaches address and deal with their players? That's the issue that we'll get into next as we head to the second hour of The Classroom, your weekly smart look at sports here on Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. We're back in The Classroom, second hour of your weekly smart look at sports. I'm Jeff Brault. He's Keith Strudler. Mike Wallace alongside, normally I say operating the audio board and making this program listenable, but that is not a mantle that Mike Wallace wants this morning. You psyched yourself out, Mike, before the show when Strudler was late, very late. Barely made it here before the show went on air. And we should mention he's the only one with access to this studio, so we can't open the door
without him. There's a reason
for
that.
Let's just blame him.
Well, it's obviously his fault.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that. We don't need to kick a man when he's down. But, Mike, you psyched yourself out. You're like, oh, there's a lot of pressure on me now. And let me tell you, you have wilted under that pressure.
Yes, you have. Your job is to make sure that people don't understand how incompetent I am. That's the goal.
It's a tough job.
What do you think of those hats, those you know, the...
Like, was that a pillbox hat? Is that a pillbox?
You know, the ones that the old-timey, you know, political hats there?
I don't like them.
Why not?
A Trump supporter is wearing them.
Well, that's it, but I
wouldn't like it if a Hillary supporter was wearing it, too. I'll give you that. They're an awful hat.
I would think you would
because
like
Because I'm not attending a baseball game in 1925. That's why I don't like them.
I would think you would like those.
I don't. I'm actually not a big hat person.
I'm surprised. I would have thought that you might have liked them.
Is it the hairline?
You do have a receding hairline.
I sure do.
How's that going to play out in the long term?
I'm going to eventually have a very short haircut is how that's going to play out in the long term.
Is that something you think about a lot?
Not really. There's nothing I can do about it. I try not to spend a lot of time worrying about things that I have no control
over. Oh, it's a great way to live your life. Unfortunately, it's just not realistic. I mean, is there a plan? Like, if I were in your shoes, I'd have a long-term strategy for how I'm going to deal with it.
Eventually, I'm just going to keep cutting my hair shorter and shorter and shorter until eventually I'm not cutting it shorter. It just doesn't grow anymore.
Do you think that this – so if I were you, I would want to – I'd want to find, you know, a lady friend as soon as possible.
Nah. It's irrelevant. If you're the type of person who think a haircut determines things, Irrelevant.
Oh, yes.
Irrelevant.
Yes.
So shallow of
you. Oh, yes.
That's, it is. It's so shallow of you.
Right.
It's shallow of you. You assume that the only people that are going – the only people that are worthy of like and love are people that conform to the Keith Strudler ideal.
Oh,
like,
God.
There's this box right. of characteristics sure. that you must have. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, no one will like you.
Right.
Like, these things matter.
Yes.
Like, the world lives at the depth that you live in.
You're right. So people like, let's say, I don't know, Matthew McConaughey, it's shallow that women are attracted to him. It has nothing to do with his dashing good looks.
But my point is,
pretty nice head, mane of hair.
People
up there,
are
too.
Equally attracted to Jude Law, who's got a hairline that makes mine look like Elvis.
I don't know about equally, and you're no.
Oh, I think Jude Law is on the exact same level as Matthew McConaughey.
And to quote Lloyd Benson, I know Jude Law. I've worked with Jude Law, and you, sir, are no Jude Law.
But that wasn't the point. The point is...
the point is whatever the point is.
Different strokes for different folks. There's a lid for every pot.
Do you think that more... This is getting someplace I didn't want to be.
Oh, I can't believe that's happened
beautiful
on this program.
Beautiful women, and all women, everyone's beautiful in their own way. But do you think more classically attractive women are attracted to men with a long head of hair, beautifully...
I honestly don't.
Oh, God.
I don't.
Oh, yeah.
Haven't you heard bald is beautiful?
No.
It's a thing. Google it. Google it. I think everybody likes different things.
Yeah. No, but there are things that people like more than others. If we go.
I mean, are you talking on a grand statistical basis?
Yes.
Maybe.
Sure. There's, you know, it's a bell curve. And in the big fat middle of that bell curve is the good-looking guy with the full head of hair.
In your world, this is what's ridiculous about your world. In your world, because someone has a preference.
Right.
You assume that means that everything else is therefore excluded.
No.
If somebody's like, you know what? My favorite soda is Coca-Cola. In your world, that means they would never drink anything else but Coca-Cola.
Sure.
In the real world, it means they like Coca-Cola the most.
So
but you know what they're not opposed to? Having a Dr. Pepper. Maybe some days they'll have an orange soda.
So,
and those are good, too. And you know what? If somebody gives you a really ice cold and delicious glass of Dr. Pepper, that's fine. And you can be exceptionally happy with that glass of Dr. Pepper.
So you're
don't live in a black and white world, Keith Strudler.
You're really holding that one in for a while.
You are now the Fanta, the Fresca of the dating world. And once a year, people might drink you in. You're right. I'd prefer to be the classic Coke. Then, you know what? I might be in the fridge all year round. I might make it into every lunchbox and every soda machine. You, on the other hand, you know what I haven't had in a long time? A Fresca. Congratulations. If that's how you want to live. Yeah, you know what I had last night? A Fresca.
And it was great and fulfilling. And I'm surprised how long I could drink it.
Now that is too far. That... That is unnecessary.
Oh, you talk about emotionally abusive.
But I'm just
you, sir, are the Mike Lonergan of the classroom.
Oh, I'll take that. I bet he got a good severance package.
He hasn't been fired.
He hasn't been fired yet?
No. He's probably not going to be fired. Let's fill the folks in. Mike Lonergan is the head men's basketball coach.
Didn't read the press release, obviously.
Is the head men's basketball coach at George Washington University. Very successful. He's won at least 20 games in each of the last three seasons. His record, 97-70 in five seasons at the helm in the very competitive Atlantic 10 Conference. But Mike Lonergan's program has been plagued by some problems. 13 players in the last 5 years have transferred out. And it's usually a big problem in college athletics when a mass number of players leave. A lot of the players that have left have done so saying that Mike Lonergan is verbally and emotionally abusive. Should be noted, the players that have left were not receiving a ton of playing time. We're not the best players on the George Washington roster. In fact, just recently, some of the best players that George Washington has had under Mike Lonergan have come out in support of Coach Lonergan and said, yeah, he'll get on you, but he's a really good coach, and I'm happy I played for him, and he helped me become a better basketball player, and we had a lot of success. Now, Mike Lonergan, under investigation at George Washington, because of these allegations of emotional and verbal abuse. Dr. Strudler, what is the role of a coach in the world that we live in here in 2016?
Well, I would say first and foremost, at the NCAA level, regardless of the charter of the university, their goal is to win. Right? That's what they get paid to do. And so I would imagine as long as they fit within a loose kind of framework of what coaches do, they need to win, right? They need to win and keep their players eligible and win, right? And do that year after year after year and generate wins for the university, which generates revenue. I would assume as a byproduct of that, because you could make the argument that most athletic departments or most athletic programs at most universities are simply arms of the marketing division, right? Because most of them do run in the red. Outside of the Michigans and the Floridas and the Texas.
Yeah, there's like 12 schools that make money on their athletic program.
So you could.
Well, at least say they do. Right. Most private institutions, if you look at this, break dead even to the dollar.
Sure.
Amazing how that works.
Student activity fees, sure. Yeah. So we understand that essentially, athletic programs are there to be a marketing tool, a very expensive and very visible marketing tool of the university. If they get a lot of publicity, that reflects well on the university. Typically, that's done by winning games. Getting into bowl games, getting to the NCAA tournament, reflecting well, graduating your players, whatever it is, all right? So that's typically the job. However, when you have something like this, it reflects you're laughing at something.
I am. I am. I was thinking about my Fanta joke earlier.
You're really proud of that.
It's funny. I liked it.
I mean, you like that. So I'm trying to do a serious discussion of
yeah,
what coaches.
It's hard, isn't it?
So.
See how the other half lives.
Right. I would make the argument that if the coach is garnering negative publicity for the university, then he's not doing his job. No matter how well or poorly he's coaching, he's not doing his job. Now, I'm imagining that what's happening at GW has happened at countless universities across the nation. And there are players that have grown accustomed to that style of coaching.
This is not the first report of emotionally abusive coaches, and in fact, emotionally and verbally abusive coaches at I'm trying to think of ones that come to mind. The women's basketball coach at Boston University was fired a couple years ago for being emotionally and verbally abusive. I mean, I think what happened at Rutgers veered into physical abuse, but I think much more than the physical abuse was a verbal breakdown.
It was much. I mean, the physical abuse was very – he threw a ball at someone. And let's be honest, yes. These are tough guys.
Physical
that doesn't
abuse
matter.
Inexcusable. I don't think you get to throw things at people.
It's inexcusable, but I would argue anyone who was in that program was much more concerned with the emotional abuse than the physical abuse. I don't think anyone was there like, oh, my God, he's going to throw a ball at my head. That wasn't their fear. Their fear or their concerns were that they were getting abused, verbally every day at practice, being told they're horrible and they'll never amount to anything. That's what was challenging.
Have athletes changed? Are athletes different now than they were, back then?
I don't know. I mean, society's changed, so perhaps athletes have changed along with that. I mean, we are much more attuned to the fact that you can't say certain things to certain people at certain times. I think that's something we're all keenly aware of. So whether today's athletes are more kind of in tune to that, perhaps. I think certainly we're in a culture that's much more open to understanding that. And it's much easier to publicize. If you people have voices now. And maybe this is just a byproduct of everyone having, social platform to public. But people feel that they have a voice. And I don't know that people felt that comfortable having, speaking out before.
The athletes who have levied these allegations against Mike Lonergan have done so anonymously. And according to the Washington Post.
Which I understand, by the way.
I do too. One former player told the Washington Post, quote, "I don't think the guy should be in sports. I don't think what he said should be tolerated. I would like to stay at GW, but I will not play for Mike Lonergan." A report of the types of things he said. This is, again, according to the Washington Post. Mike Lonergan told one player that he belonged in, quote, a transgender league. Another thing that he said is he told one of his players.
Which, by the way, as far as I know, I don't know of one.
I suppose not.
Interesting.
He also
so offensive at all levels.
He suggested another player's son would forever rely on public assistance. So that's an example of a type of things that Mike Lonergan has said. Again, that's according to the Washington Post. One former player said that he needed therapy to cope with a couple years playing under Mike Lonergan.
What's interesting about those comments, it might shed some insight into the coach. those weren't just kind of attacks onto the players, but they also were offensive to groups.
Yeah. Outside.
I mean, that was offensive to transgendered athletes.
Yes.
So there's a certain lack of sensitivity that goes – just looking at some athletes saying you'll never amount to anything, you're a horrible basketball player, that's one thing.
Yeah, and I think there's clearly some racist undertones to telling a player that his son will forever be on public assistance.
There's bigotry that exists in this that I think is more revealing to the coach's character, and I think that's just as problematic. And I'm sure that's – look, a lot of athletes don't mind having a coach that drills them.
Right.
That's
some actually want it.
Yeah. There are certain athletes that thrive under that environment, that thrive under a coach that is always on them, that always makes them feel like they're not doing enough. That's okay. There's something that's a little bit more a lot more insensitive and mean-spirited that isn't just attacking the performance and isn't just attacking them personally, and both of those things do that, but it's also showing a remarkable insensitivity to the world outside.
I agree with that insensitivity to the world, but when I read the comments, the comments that were reported in the Washington Post about things that Mike Lonergan allegedly said to his players, the first thing that I think of is that Mike Lonergan is just a jerk who thinks he's being funny and edgy, but is just being a jerk.
Well, one of the things,
it sounds like the way he's saying these things, the way that they're phrased in the Washington Post, it sounds like the way, you know, it doesn't sound like the way a hateful person would say these things. It sounds like the way a guy would try to be funny, but is failing miserably. Now, it's not necessarily make the comments excusable.
No.
But it doesn't seem mean spirited.
Well, we don't know obviously the context. We aren't in the practice, and
no.
So we don't know the context in which these things were said. And we don't – I guess that was kind of leading to the next point I was going to make. There are a lot of coaches – you know, you hear the term players coach be thrown around a lot. Let's take someone like Cal Perrin, who's always the lightning rod for anything.
Sure.
I think if you talk to any or if you hear from any of the athletes who played under Cal – and Krzyzewski would be the same way. Krzyzewski, who is a tough coach. They all would say their coach – down deep, they knew their coach really cared about them and would do anything for them. And Krzyzewski's a great example because he's under the Bobby Knight tree. He is a drill sergeant. He was a military guy. Like he gets that, right? And so but on the other hand, if you talk to any of us or you hear from any of his former athletes, they'll tell you Coach K cares about them more than anything. What I'm gathering, and I don't know enough about this, is these players certainly wouldn't believe that. These players certainly don't believe that, he goes into us pretty hard, but on the other hand, he'd fight for us. Or he's the guy I'm going to come back and see 10 years from now when I get married and have kids, and he's the guy who's going to go to bat for me to get a job, which is what you'll see Coach K and Cal,
so,
that's what they would do.
So two of George Washington's best players in the last 5 years have gone to bat for Mike Lonergan. Maurice Cheek, who spent one season at GW after transferring to Indiana, said, quote, "I never felt like he crossed the line. As a basketball player, you know the coaches are going to be who they are, but he never crossed the line with me, and I never saw him cross the line with any of the guys. He just wanted to win games." Another former GW star.
And that, by the way, that's very telling. There's that other side of it, which is, and again, the question isn't, those are two different issues. Whether he crossed the line or not, that's one issue, but whether the athletes feel like they're there for them, that's a separate issue.
Perhaps. Another former GW star, Patricio Guarino, posted on Twitter that he was, quote, shocked to read the allegations against his former coach, Mike Lonergan, and he doesn't agree with any of them. He said, quote, "Coach is very old school, and he's going to push you to the limits to reach your potential. Even though we went at each other a few times, I know he did it because he knew I was able to perform better, and that's something that I appreciate because it got me to where I am today."
I know we're going to have to go to break soon, but there's one kind of closing thought with all of this, and I think this happens in a lot of athletic programs across the country, and it's been the genesis of a lot of the negative things that have happened in athletic departments. They tend to operate in a bit of a cocoon.
Oh, absolutely they do.
And that's something that universities have tried to break up. But it's very hard to change because these teams operate essentially as cohorts. They essentially live together, even though they don't necessarily actually live together.
They actually usually do live together.
Yeah, but the dorms, like they'll put them in,
Integrated dorms. Very, very frequently.
They might room
players,
together.
Players
yeah.
will move off campus yes. and live in a house yes. with their teammates.
Yes.
I mean, they very, very often live
look,
together.
I did that in college. I mean, I live with a bunch of track guys in college. Like, it's no different. Sport by sport.
Right. No, not at all.
You live together. You travel together, right?
Usually you are each other's best friends. Not always, but it's very frequent.
I have a good percentage of my friends in college were track guys. And that's just a normal kind of way of doing it. I think in basketball it's intensified because of the travel schedule.
You're bonded together. You work toward a common goal. You're with each other a long time. You tend to be very like-minded.
You also understand the pressures you're undergoing. You understand why you're nervous X night and Y night.
But it speaks to your point of an insular society.
But it becomes very insular. And when the coach becomes the guardian and the boss and the president of that essential institution, which doesn't exist for anyone else in the college. Everyone else in the college, you might have a professor that seems a little bit over the edge or is rough, but that professor and that class operates within the larger framework of checks and balances at the university. That's not what happens in most athletic programs where, the coach becomes judge, jury, executioner, and everything. And that creates an environment, particularly when you have a singular goal that is so important, that is so key, and everyone's been told is so vital. I think it's easy for everyone to lose perspective. And I think these athletes are just, in many cases, responding to the fact that this coach has completely lost perspective of what this is supposed to be about.
Possible. Again, a large number of athletes who have been successful at George Washington have defended Mike Lonergan. The 13 players that have left, none of them were considered star players, major contributors. Obviously, 13 in 5 years is a big number, so make you think that something is going on.
But there is a waterfall effect.
When I look at verbal abuse, to me, abuse is trying to break someone down and make them feel lesser and make them feel like they're not good, right?
And to assert dominance over someone, but to
keep someone lower.
Yes.
To be a successful coach, do you not need to elevate? Do you not need to make sure that you get the best out of it? Like, what does Mike Lonergan benefit by making his players feel worse about themselves, by making them feel like they are lesser basketball players? How does that benefit
him? But I think there is certainly a form of dominance that he's able to achieve. So if these people feel worse about themselves and he thinks that he can make his players do anything to get some kind of affirmation from him, and now we're playing pop psychologist, by the way.
Yes.
But that seems to be a very likely scenario. You break them down. Maybe he's just not a nice guy.
It certainly seems like from the quotes that were anonymously reported, he's an idiot and a jerk.
Well, that's a little
he's saying stupid things.
Yeah.
I mean, you can tell someone that they're a soft basketball player without telling them they should play in a transgender league. Like, there's a right way and a wrong way to say these things. But is the intention behind what he's saying abusive?
I think we're probably overanalyzing to try to infer intent. I'm guessing a hyper competitive guy who's probably not all that nice, who didn't necessarily learn the difference between right and wrong in some cases, and is taking out his players. And you know what? He's also had a system that's worked for him. He wins a lot of basketball games, and so that's you live and die by the system in which you operate. Who's under a lot of pressure.
I guess it is incumbent on coaches to reach players the way that they need to be reached, right? Not everybody is going to respond to the same type of coach. Some people want you, if you're coaching them or teaching them, to tell you how awful you are and what you need to do to improve to become better. And some people don't respond to that.
That's how I like my marriage. Awkward segue. That was awkward. Not a segue.
I don't know where to go. I feel like we're starting a therapy session.
We are. Well, you've just made yourself the Fanta of the dating world.
To be fair, I was Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, I made you Fresca.
Yeah.
Fresca's really, because Fresca is the ultimate kind of like boutique, you have it every now and then soda.
Yeah,
very
you don't
niche.
See a Fresca every
Fresca's
day.
Very niche. Yeah. You know who has Fresca? Cristel Giorno, our advanced friend. He has Fresca in his office.
I feel like I'm in good company now. I like that. I'm good with that. That's fine with me.
You're in Cristel Giorno's fridge.
We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to get into biometrics in sports and how athletes can increase their performance by keeping their body in peak condition, how they can know how to keep their body in peak condition. It's going to be a pretty interesting discussion. So stay tuned for that next. More of your weekly Smart Look at Sports after this on Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. You can like The Classroom on Facebook, search for ESPN The Classroom. Follow us on Twitter at ESPN_Classroom. And one note to our Twitter followers. Our most recent tweet, which Keith Stroller and Mike Wallace claim supports their version of what a teleprompter is, actually supports my version of what a teleprompter is. So as you read it's attacking me.
No.
But again, I am correct and they are wrong, and I do think that's important for everyone to realize.
It's a real important question. Mm-hmm. Have you ever admitted that you're wrong?
Yes.
When?
When I'm wrong. When I'm wrong.
I want an example.
I'm just not wrong that often. I know that hurts you. You realize that I have looked at teleprompters professionally for a fair number of years in my adult life.
Okay.
I've read off them as well.
Well, you've never read through a see-through one.
Yeah, they're all see-through. They're all see-through. All of them.
No, they're not.
Some are more see-through than
others.
That's
right.
All right, Animal Farm. All pigs are equal, but some are more equal than others.
It's not that all pigs,
all animals. Spread. All animals are equal.
That's right. You keep saying that.
Well, the pigs are the leaders. They're the ones that wrote it. You got your Napoleon and the other one. I forget his name. It's been a while since I read Animal Farm. Napoleon's the name of one of the pigs.
We should do like a books on tape here in the classroom.
Well, we had a great book segment that we did a number of times. Do you know your book better than a Marist Center for Sports Communication intern who just read it?
Yes,
that was great. But
that actually came up the other day when I was at a little name dropping. I was out at the Sports PR Digital Workshop. Sports PR Summit Digital Workshop out at Twitter headquarters this past week. I spent a little time at Bleacher Report. Met a lot of very important people.
You cursed Dan Dickow out of the tournament.
Did not. Did not.
You're the reason a few good men lost in the basketball tournament.
I did not. I probably should have gone out. Where was the game?
I don't know.
I should have gone and played. I should have been on the coach with them. I could have taken John Stockton's place. Should have been out there.
What's it like inside your head?
Dan Dickow, he's just not that much taller than I am, too. I expect him to be bigger.
Why don't you take Dan Dickow's place? Why don't you get out there and show off your handles?
I actually went and shot.
Like, guys, I got bad news. Dan couldn't make it, but he sent me.
This is when I kidnapped him and locked him in a closet. I went and shot some hoops when I was out in San Francisco with a friend of mine. We went to like a gym, and you know what's really hard? First of all, making a basket is hard. But secondly, I understand why they award points for it. It's challenging. But secondly, those practice – they do the practice ones where it's the ball shoot – they shoot the ball back out at you. You know, they have that machine.
Yeah, the gun. They call it the gun.
All right. Whatever it's called.
It's called the gun. That's what it's called? It says it on the side of the thing.
All right. But with the gun
– Michael Walsh is nodding. It does say that.
You put it under the basket, and it's got that net.
Yes.
It's hard to shoot over that net. That net's high.
Well, it's actually not supposed to be hard to shoot over the net.
No, it makes you shoot it higher. It makes you shoot it high.
Makes you shoot it correctly.
Ball goes in the basket however you want the ball to go in the basket, but now you have to shoot over. You have to shoot it with an arc to get it over that thing. I know. It'll keep you from getting your shots blocked. I know. I don't want to play in a league that's athletic enough that people are trying to block each other people's shots.
Do you know? I don't even know how to unpack that. Do you know what might help you become a better athlete?
Whoop.
Some analytics.
Oh, the data would not be good. We just want to make sure that's right. Is that a 4-inch vertical? Did you eat 2 boxes of Little Debbie snack cakes today?
Are you an analytical data person when it comes to sports? Like, were you ever into this with your running, with your triathlons?
So it's really interesting. I am remarkably low-tech when it comes to myself and doing triathlons and running. But I actually – and that's a personal preference because I want to go out and I want to enjoy it. On the other hand, and I don't want to be so dedicated because I've never wanted to be the best in the world in anything because I knew that was never going to happen. On the other hand – I think and fully appreciate that the people that can integrate those analytics without letting them drive them crazy. And I think there's a two-edged sword on analytics, which is if you let – you know, I'd see people with these – with very high-tech watches at races, and I'd remind them that the watch isn't going to do the race. Like, they'd be like, well, I have to do this because my watch – I was like, well, you know, remember, the watch doesn't do the race.
Right,
the legs have to do
the race. It's the Indian, not the arrow, that kind of thing.
And so, you know, people are being dictated during performance. I'm like, look, you're going to go as hard as your body will let you go, and that's what you need to do. On the other hand, people who can smartly use the data and the analytics, particularly in training. I think in racing it's a little bit different. But in training, people who can use this data and can mentally deal with living a more Spartan life, I guess, in some regards, because this is going to change the way it might remove you from some of your natural way of doing things. People with that ability, I think absolutely. I think there's a reason why we're better athletes than we were 20 years ago today. I mean, why performance is better, and it's not just because we have better drugs.
Yeah, we in the classroom, we do like to look forward. We like to see how technology is impacting sports. It's a thing that we talk about at length. And right now we're going to talk about the Whoop Performance Optimization System. And joining us in the classroom to do that is Eric Vent, who is the Elite Performance Manager of Whoop, and he's an Olympian.
Yeah.
A U.S. Olympian.
Is this our second Olympian on the show?
No, we've had a few.
Oh, no, we've had Winter, too.
We've had a few Olympians. Yeah. I mean, we're putting together a pretty good Olympic roster here.
That's true. We could be one of the – we got to be a rogue nation, get this show back together.
We could play for the team that Mike Wallace wants to play for, the refugee nation. We'll all renounce our citizenship.
Perfect.
Eric Venn, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Tell us about this performance optimization system that you guys have designed. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's actually phenomenal. And I kind of come at it more so from the athlete's perspective more than anything else. And really what it is, to kind of give you a high-level view, it's a wearable device that the athletes wear around their wrist, but it also comes in conjunction with a software analytical platform that's meant to aid an athlete in really ultimately understanding more about his body and understanding how his body is responding to various stressors. And those stressors could be something as obvious as training or game day or race day, or less obvious, something like travel, or, you know, even in some athletes, like a big Saturday night out. You know, and with that, and as athletes get to understand objectively how each decision they're making, whether it be social stress or, you know, workout related, how it's understanding and how it's affecting their body is really empowering the athlete to a level that we really haven't seen before in sports.
It seems like it gets very minute, like it tracks very small details and can offer relatively small changes that can make a big difference. What kind of things is it measuring?
So we have three pillars of our software platform. So we have sleep, recovery, and strain. And that sleep is sleep lab type quality analysis. And that recovery is based off of heart rate variability and resting heart rate. And heart rate variability, not to get too scientific and too deep down the rabbit hole, but it's a very early indication in athlete overtraining, athlete fatigue. A lot of different teams, a lot of different sports are using that metric for a variety of reasons. But as athletes begin to understand more and more about their body, that's one of the things that they're kind of gravitating towards our platform for. But to kind of give you a sense of how granular the system that we have goes, we have five different metrics that we're tracking continuously. And those metrics are heart rate variability, skin conductivity, ambient temperature, and accelerometry, which is ostensibly motion. And each one of those metrics, we're taking 100 points of data per second, which comes out to, you know, per sensor, roughly 1 million points of data per day. So the granular view that we're getting into each athlete's body is something that really hasn't been seen before.
So taking this from the athlete's perspective, and you were an Olympian, was it 1984 an Olympian?
No. I was 2004 and 2008. I think I was 3 years old in 84.
1984?
Sorry,
you're literally 20 years off.
Something that was right in front of me.
1984. This would be a good time to mention, Eric, that Keith Strudler arrived to the studio 3 minutes before we went on air.
I was reading something.
Do you have any way to sort of improve his training to do a better job?
Help everybody, trust me.
I was speaking with Carolyn Joyce, actually, this past week. Who you may be.
Oh, great. Carolyn's a very good friend of mine. I just saw her at Olympic Trials a few weeks ago when we were watching all the guys make the team.
I was speaking with her at the Sports PR Summit. Oh, a little name drop. That made my co-host angry because I'm now in the middle of a conversation.
Hey, Mike, you know who I was talking to this week?
I was
talking to our friend Jack.
Yeah. Wow.
Can you believe it? Look how injured everybody is.
You don't have a friend Jack. Well, your friend Jack, that's not Jack Ford.
How do you know?
Oh, I'm pretty sure.
We bond over our love of FCS football.
He would have talked to me. All right, so since 2004, just to today, there's been a lot more emphasis, certainly on body-worn apparatuses. Obviously, the data and analytics has become a much bigger part of this landscape. I mean, I certainly not an Olympic athlete, but I graduated college in 1992 and I ran track. We basically, when we felt tired, we backed off a little bit. You tried to take your pulse rate here and there and all that kind of stuff. Do you think, though, that the analytics in any way hinders athletes? Is there any backlash? And you would know this as someone who trained a lot. Do you ever feel like the numbers start to drive the train and it starts to be a tail wagging the dog? How do you, because obviously you're consulting with athletes in using this technology, how do you ensure that the data and the technology becomes an aid and not, I don't say a crutch, but the thing that makes them almost subconscious of what they're doing? So some days you just feel good and you just want to go. How do you make this work for the athletes?
Absolutely, and I think that's a great question. I mean, ultimately, you know, we want to be an aid to the athlete and to the coach. You know, there's a lot of coaches using us for a lot of different ways, and we always encourage them to use this as a tool to understand more about their athletes bodies and how they're responding to each one of their stressors. And like I said, that could be workout related, that could be game related. And for me, so when I come at this, I look at it at how it would have aided my career. And if you guys saw me, you can't. I'm over the phone, but look, I'm 5'10", nothing. You would be shocked if I made 3 Olympic Games and was able to win a couple silvers and a gold in the process. And the reason why I did that was because I trained my butt off day in and day out. And because of that, I fell into the traps of overtraining on a continual basis. So for me, I look at this as an opportunity to aid those guys in understanding when their body's getting too worn down, too beat up. Then they can kind of pull back. And with that, their bodies won't enter into that trap of overtraining. And when you enter into that trap, it does get bad. It gets hard because it's hard to get yourself out of it. It's hard to get your body to recover. And it takes months. And I've fallen into that trap a couple different times. So I look at this as an opportunity, one, for the athletes to really understand how to govern their lives on a day-to-day basis. You know, I always said, okay, no matter what I do, if I get into the pool and I work my tail off, that's all I need to worry about. Towards the end of my career, I realized that what happens outside of those 5 hours in the pool and in the weight room each day is really what's going to affect how much more I improve. And so small things. It's the sleep. It's the recovery. It's optimizing your lifestyle outside of the training area, outside of the game arena. And with that, the athletes will just get better. It's really as simple as that.
Well, by the way, I just want to make a correction here. I did have the correct date in front of me, and I just misread it. It says 2004 right in front of me.
That doesn't make it better.
Well, no, I'm saying I was wrong. I'm doing something you've never done in your life, which you're not doing about the teleprompter.
You know what I don't do?
What?
Look at 2004 and say 1984.
No, it didn't add up to me. I knew this was wrong, but I will, you do the same thing. You'll read anything in front of you.
Yeah, but you didn't read what was in front of you, and that was the problem.
I remembered what I thought I had read. And then what happened? Could you tell us some of the?
You're the only person who can apologize and make it seem that what you did was worse.
it's always the cover up to get you. Eric, tell us some of the athletes that are using it, and does this technology work better in certain sports? I would imagine at swimming, track. There's certain sports that where you do run right up to the edge physiologically. But who's using it, and what are some of the gains that they've seen, and what kind of sports are the most likely to benefit from these kind of things?
Yeah, so like I said, there's a lot of different sports using us for a variety of reasons. Given the connections I have into the Olympic movement, we've gotten quite a bit of Olympians on this platform from the obvious swimmers. We've got about, I would say, a quarter of the U.S. national team heading to Rio right now who are using it. We get some track and field guys, some less obvious sports like swimming, kayaking, that type of stuff, volleyball. We have those sports. So the Olympic movement is really starting to grab a hold of this because ultimately these guys are looking for every single thing they can do to get better. And so, especially as they're heading into Rio. And if that means they get more sleep, and obviously sleep correlates very well to athletic performance, and this encourages them and helps them optimize and make their sleep more efficient, they're jumping on this wholeheartedly. Outside of that, we're seeing a lot of NBA players begin to use it, NBA players, NBA teams. I would say basketball and swimming are our two biggest sports. But given the metric that we track, which is HRV, and given how we track it, we have very strong intellectual property around that. We calculate that over the last 5 minutes of slow wave sleep, and with that we have a patent. And that is hands down the most optimal time to take it. So given the importance of HRV in a variety of different sports, there are a lot of guys coming to us, and across the NFL, NBA, soccer is another big one because it's a very strong cardiovascular sport. So ultimately, swimming and basketball are two biggest sports, but the implications of this are certainly cross many.
Oh, Jeff, just a quick point here. I'll get you your question. When you heard that patent thing, were you thinking Shark Tank?
Of course. Of course I was. That's the first thing I was saying. I'm like, I will give you $100,000 for 10% of your company.
I think we're all thinking the same thing here. Mark Cuban would be all over this. This is a Mark Cuban deal.
This is a Mark Cuban deal.
Yeah.
But then again, Robert
Hirschbeck. He does love technology, that's for sure. And he certainly loves technology that will obviously help his basketball team.
You can tell us.
To give you some specific names and some really encouraging stuff that I've seen, and I'll start with Conor Yeager, who's 1500 American record holder, world championship silver medalist, fantastic guy, and really bought into the WHOOP platform wholeheartedly about a year ago. And with that, he was able to govern and understand more about his body, especially when he traveled. And so when he would, you know, travel and do, you know, a press appearance out in L.A., for example, he would cross time zones. And what he realized is that his body took a much longer than he anticipated to acclimate to this time zone.
Yes, like I just came home from San Francisco.
He was able to, you know, head out to Olympic trials a few days early than he would have previously, crushed it on the first day, made the Olympic team, went a personal best, and now he punched his ticket to Rio. We just have anecdotes like that kind of across the board. But when I look at that, I think that is kind of, you know, what WHOOP is in a nutshell. It's going to give athletes the opportunity to take more ownership over their careers, ultimately.
We're talking with Eric Venn of WHOOP. You can find out more online at whoop.com, whoop.com. I'm wondering about the psychology of an athlete and how that plays into whether they feel like this data will help them. Because I think some people are more predetermined to wanting the data and wanting the analytics. And then other people are more just like, oh, I'm an elite athlete. I'm just going to go out there and I'm going to feel it. I'm good at this. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to trust it. Yeah. I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan. Chip Kelly did a lot of this, especially the sleep monitoring with his athletes. And a number of guys were like, hey, I think this is great. It's helping me. It's helping me reach my peak performance. And other players were like, I don't want my coach knowing how I'm going to sleep. What does he care? I'm going to sleep when I want to sleep. Do you find, Eric, that certain athletes are more determined to want to embrace this data than others? And do you think the ones that don't want to embrace it are deficient in some way?
No, not at all. And I think, and you're right, there's various types of athletes, and there's athletes who are like, look, man, I know what I do, and I do it well. I don't need this to tell me. But to get back on Chip Kelly for a second, I mean, there's a reason why that NFL team has the least amount of injuries over the past 3 years. And that's because of the sports science analytics that Chip Kelly implemented. So, yes, the athletes might sit there and say, hey, coach, you got me for 4 hours a day. You don't need me for the other 20. And to a certain, you know, to a certain degree, I can see that. I can understand that. Look, I mean, I was an athlete, too, that competed at a high level. You know, you value your privacy. But ultimately, if you can take a step back and look at the bigger picture and go, okay, well, if I can play five more years and earn another $15 million rather than get injured, then I might buy into this. So athletes, even the ones who are on the fence about it, are kind of taking a step back and saying, this is a chance for me to elongate my career and maximize my earning potential. And that's on the professional level, where privacy does reign supreme, especially when you're dealing with the Players Association and whatnot. But on the Olympic level, when these guys are individual athletes and they're just looking for that extra special sauce, they're buying into it wholeheartedly. But slowly but surely, on that professional level, because they're looking at this as an opportunity to maximize their earning potential, they're becoming much, much warmer to it.
That was a good point. Chip Kelly did keep players on the field performing poorly. They were healthy.
They were
out there losing and losing frequently. That's a very good point. I didn't look at that.
So, Eric, I understand the applications for Olympic athletes and for elite and professional athletes. What are the applications for the non-elite athletes? Or is there? Is this a product that is used primarily and almost exclusively for people who are performing at the highest level? Or is this a product that, and I would assume for marketing purposes and for, you know, to be able to monetize, there should be some mainstream applications. Is there value to people who do sports at a lower level?
Like the weekend warriors.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I think those guys in particular are going to love this thing. I mean, anybody who cares, like anybody who is like semi on that quantified self movement, which most everybody is at this point.
Not two of the people in this room. You've
is going to, in my opinion, is going to love this. I mean, like, who wouldn't want to know how well they slept? I've learned so much more about my sleep by using this product, and that's something that subjectively nobody, whether you're an athlete or not, will ever know. So to be able to objectively measure sleep, that's only going to help you when it comes to, you know, cognitive behavioral type stuff when you go into the office. It's going to help you sharply when you're on the baseball field. It doesn't really matter. So that sleep is going to be hugely important to anybody. And a lot of people that I speak to love the sleep aspect of it, and they love the ability, they love the opportunity to kind of learn from that, take steps to improve that, and with that, life follows. So I look at this ultimately not just as a, you know, performance optimization tool for elite athletes, but a lifestyle management tool for them as well. And that lifestyle management will span the spectrum between elite athlete and, you know, your weekend warrior, your prosumer, your triathlete, your CrossFit junkie. Those guys that really want to understand more about their bodies and how to optimize everything on the back end are going to love it, because the granularity that we provide is, and I love it, it's the granularity that we provide has never been seen before. So when people are like, oh, it's like a Fitbit, I'm like, only in the sense that you wear it around your wrist. But outside of that, nothing we track have you ever seen before. So that granularity is going to really open people's eyes up and is going to, you know, get them hooked, in my opinion.
It's cool technology. It's cutting edge. Check it out online, whoop.com, WHOOP.com. Eric, before we let you go, we have not had before an Olympic gold medal swimmer on the program. We talked either last week or 2 weeks ago, I can't remember, about what Michael Phelps has done in his career. He's going to his fifth Olympics, I think 21 medals, 18 golds. I think him getting to his fifth Olympics has to be considered one of the greatest sporting accomplishments of all time. I think he has to be in the discussion for greatest athlete of all time. You as a swimmer who's
competed with Michael Phelps.
I mean, how do you sort of put what he's done into words and rank it among the great accomplishments that we've seen?
You know, I got a silver to Michael in 2004 in the 400 Diamond. Oh, so you know, I've known him since he was a young pup at 15, and we've been on national teams pretty much straight through. So I know him very well. We trained together leading up to 2008, where he had, in my opinion, those 8 days in Beijing were the greatest athletic accomplishment in history, because I know exactly how hard it is to compete at that level. And never mind just do it one time or have to do it two times or three times through like prelims, semis, and finals. That guy did that 24 times throughout the course of 8 days, and he came out with 8 gold medals. And the thing that separates Michael, I think, from anybody else, and he's got that Michael Jordan-type mentality. When the chips are on the table is when he performs his best, always. Not sometimes, always. And I think what we're going to see in Rio is more along those lines. He's hands down the best swimmer that's ever existed, and you know, I think he'll cement his legacy as one of the best athletes of all time in Rio.
I'm thinking about, like, if you get a silver medal to the greatest of all time, that almost makes it, like, the best possible silver. Well, like, there's such a great story behind that. What? You're like, yeah, I got the silver, but guess who got the gold?
But no, it's like when you lose. when you lose.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's a catch-22, you know? But, I mean, it's certainly cool to be a part of his story. More so when I was training with him leading up to 2008, I would say those were some really fun times. We pushed each other really far in workout. And to kind of see what he accomplished was absolutely amazing. And on top of that, you know, I went to Olympic trials, you know, a couple weeks ago, and what it is now in comparison to where it was in 2000 when I first showed up on the scene, it's night and day. I mean, you're talking like a rinky-dink meet versus an extravagant event that is on prime time 8 days in a row, and that is in large part due to Michael. And I think the sport of swimming owes him a huge, huge debt of gratitude.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I would say it's like when you lose in the NCAA tournament, you want that team that you lose to win the entire thing.
Yeah,
totally.
Right?
Absolutely.
So getting a silver to Michael Phelps is fantastic. And then you also, you know, I actually like the whole, I was hanging out. Like, the name-dropping thing to me is
that's all you care about.
Yes.
You don't actually want to accomplish anything. You just want to be near people that accomplish it.
Exactly. Well, that's why I was going to say, you know, Eric, just make sure to say hi to Kara, to Carolyn Joyce for me. Because that's a name
Absolutely.
Drop.
I'll shoot her a text right after this.
Let's see if she's going to remember. That guy from Maris.
Eric Vent. Eric Vent. Whoop.com. WHOP.com. Learn more about it online. Our guest in the classroom. Eric, thanks so much. This was fun.
Yeah, I appreciate it, guys. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. We got to take a break.
That was fun.
That was a lot of fun.
Especially when I screwed up.
Great. You know, that was my favorite part. Great grades of the week are next. Classroom winds down after this on Fox 1220, 97.3 ESPN Radio. We're running out of time in the classroom this morning. I'm Jeff. He's the forgettable Keith Strudler. Mike Wallace is on the board, and he is about to tell you that right now. We'll get to this morning's grades of the week.
And now for your grades of the week.
We're staying with the theme of the Rio Olympics. They kick off in the very near future. I think we're inside 2 weeks at this point. NBC will have wall-to-wall coverage. They're sending all of their top broadcasting talent. They're also adding some new broadcasters to cover the games. This week, NBC announced that two Brazilian supermodels, namely Alessandra Ambrosio and Adriana Lima, will join the NBC Olympic coverage of the games in Rio de Janeiro. Ambrosio and Lima will present features and offer commentary on the Olympics in their native Brazil during NBC's late-night coverage, hosted by Ryan Seacrest at NBC Olympics' Copacabana Beach Studio. They will also contribute to the Olympics coverage across various networks and online platforms. Keith Strudler, great, a couple of supermodels doing some sports broadcasting in Rio.
I seem uniquely qualified to do that. And again, now let's tie this show for all you that have been listening for the entire 2 hours. I apologize. The those two supermodels, they're Coca-Cola. They're Coca-Cola.
No. Those two supermodels are some type of artisanal soda that you
don't
even know exists. It's like when somebody's like, "I'm a scratch golfer," and people think that means, "Oh, you're like on the level of professionals," professionals you realize are like plus nine.
Yes,
they're the plus nines.
Yes. So I mean, I think anything that might distract to keep our eyes off the train wreck that this Olympics is going to be is probably a good thing. So I would say, at this point, not a horrible idea. We've crossed. If people are criticizing the Olympics because we have models doing coverage, it's a good day for NBC. If that's the worst that's going to happen, we're fine with that. Oh, I have to give it a grade.
The segment doesn't work unless you.
Well,
do.
I'm going to watch it. I'll give it an A.
There you go. All right, I like it. Are you? I mean, I'm like not that excited for these Olympics.
I don't normally. I've almost forgotten they're happening.
I kind of have. Like, I'm excited to watch. Really. Two sports, water polo, table tennis. Those are my two.
No, track and swimming.
Meh. Meh.
Oh, I'm going to call Eric and tell him what you said.
I'll be honest. I find those sports not that entertaining to watch.
Well, you don't find track, the Olympic track and field, to be entertaining? But you find water polo?
I do.
And what was the other one?
Table tennis.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
I want to just drive down to
Brighton
Beach and just hang out there and watch guys play.
Look,
this is
not true. Like, I understand that this is not correct.
But we'll say it anyway.
But it seems, well, no, because I mean, it just seems like when you watch swimming, when you watch track and field, you can't see and you can't detect and you can't break down the strategy that goes into it. It just seems like people going fast in one direction, and it's not that compelling to me. Like, when I watch sports, I like to watch the strategy, and I like to watch, you know, the game within the game and how things unfold and you know, the matchups and the storylines. And to me, swimming and track don't really provide that. Now, I know that there's a lot of strategy that goes into it, but it doesn't come across on television.
By the way, basketball tournament finals on a Tuesday night, August 2nd.
Oh, Tuesday. That seems odd. I bet they did that for television. They're becoming very commercial in their third year.
We can watch the semis. It looks like semis are on a Saturday. I can't make it.
Oh, so you're out.
No, I'll do the finals.
I can go on a
Tuesday night.
I can do a Tuesday night in the Bronx.
Down the Bronx. I'd like that's intense.
Yeah. Get some pizza. Yeah. $2 million on the line.
Done.
Watch a little of the tournament on ESPN's family of networks this afternoon. Learn more about it online at thetournament.com. All right, that's all we've got for the classroom this morning. We're back with you next week, 10 a.m. to noon, for another smart look at sports. Got to thank Mike Wallace, who for at least 80 to 85% of this program operated the audio board effectively. Dr. Keith Strummer, for about 80 to 85% of this program, didn't make any horrible mistakes.
Right.
And then there's
always the 15% that gets you, though.
And then there's me. The Fanta of radio hosts. Not necessarily anyone's top choice, but once in a while, very refreshing. Shaking things up. Jeff Brolin, my name. I thank you for hanging out with us. Don't forget, like us on Facebook, ESPN The Classroom. We're on Twitter at ESPN The Classroom. Archives will be available online, iTunes, podcast section. Search for ESPN The Classroom. We'll see you next week. Class is dismissed.